Tyler Kenefick on behalf of the state.
Yes, good morning. Samuel Edmonds here.
Excellent. Great. I'll ask the marshal to go ahead and call the next case.
Next case is A230327, respondent State of Minnesota versus appellant Kelly Janko Treidwasser.
All right. And counsel, I think you're both familiar with our procedures, but counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your primary argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes for your argument. We'll ask each of you to, when you're not speaking, stay muted, and then go ahead and unmute when you're it's your turn to go. Also, please state your name and who you represent for the record. There will be an audio recording available after arguments today. So, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Samuel Edmonds, and I am the attorney for the appellant in this case, Kelly Treidwasser. We raised 5 different issues in our brief. I'm going to try to focus in on the first and second issues today and suggest to the court that those two arguments are very closely related. So in our first argument, we submit that Ms. Treidwasser was denied her right to present a complete defense, to show her theory of the case to the jury. And secondly, we argue that that Ms. Treidwasser's trial counsel was ineffective. The connection I want to point out is that respondent argues that we have failed to preserve the complete defense argument. That if Ms. Treidwasser had done a better job of making an offer of proof or preserving that at the trial court, that we would be able to raise that issue in this appeal or at least argue it. So I want to note that the reason that the complete defense and the appellant's evidence is not completely preserved in the trial record is again due to the ineffective assistance of trial counsel. So those two issues cross over, kind of go back and forth. As it relates to the complete defense, I laid out in our brief a recitation of the facts and the theory, the story that Ms. Treidwasser was trying to get across to the jury in her trial.
As far as I can understand, the theory that you are asserting that she was denied was her assertion or her claim that the trooper or the personnel, the law enforcement personnel that were involved were biased against her. Is that pretty much what you're saying, that she didn't have the ability to present that credibility determination?
Yes, that's correct. And
right. In this case, the trooper testified, even if that theory was relevant, which the trial court said it wasn't, the trooper testified she crossed the fog line and failed to signal. Isn't that enough to initiate a stop in the first instance?
Well, thank you for that question, Your Honor. What I laid out in our brief is that had Ms. Treidwasser been given the opportunity, she would have made an argument about pretextual stops, and that it'd be her position.
And in what fashion would that conceivably have been presented? I mean, and again, you're talking about Mr. Kenflick's argument about your offer of proof. How would you have demonstrated that?
Your Honor, that goes to the fifth argument we raised about reopening the omnibus record. The trial court, first, the context behind that was after a year of the state failing to disclose critical pieces of evidence, those videos finally came to light, and Ms. Treidwasser got new counsel and wanted to go back to the omnibus hearing now that they had the evidence. And the trial court allowed the omnibus to be reopened only partially. So had the request to reopen the omnibus as it relates to the stop been granted, then Ms. Treebwasser would have put forth evidence of that series of prior interactions with law enforcement, some of the radio traffic evidence and the video evidence that shows the comments of officers, you know, trying to show that these officers had preconceived notions and some motivation to try to bring these allegations against Ms. Treebwasser. And so the point is that she should have been able to put forth the evidence and suggest that there may be a reason for bias. And there could have been a motivation for officers to lie. So that with that evidence at the omnibus hearing, Ms. Treebwasser would have made an argument that the stop was pretextual and that those types of stops should be disfavored. And we'd get into all of that case law over the years about pretextual stops. So then I think in addition to that, it's the same issue during the trial. The jury was the fact finder at trial, and it was necessary for the jury to evaluate the credibility of the witnesses, most importantly, the trooper that testified. There were credibility issues here about the trooper's observations of Ms. Treebwasser. You know, was she exhibiting indicia of impairment?
Well, the jury heard that audio, correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that, Your Honor.
The jury heard the audio of the denial, the refusal, correct?
The jury heard part of that recording, yes.
And throughout that recording, she's talking, your client is talking the entire time, correct?
Your Honor, yes, let me clarify. I do agree with that. The portion that I believe the court is referring to is from the squad recording that was outside of the police station, still in the car. That's when Trooper Bozer first read the breath test advisory. One significant point about that is that, you know, Trooper Bozer was in the front of the squad car. There was the plexiglass barrier between the trooper and the appellant. So there was significant dispute about, you know, whether Ms. Treebwasser was able to hear that as it was being read. But that's not the issue that we're focusing on. I do agree that portion of the tape was presented at the trial.
Well, and so my point there is the jury heard the failure to either, you know, refuse expressly or to consent. And in part because your client was trying to yell over the trooper the whole time and waging threats against the trooper. It seems to me that's a pretty strong, you know, even if this other sort of bias evidence came in, she never accepted. And the trooper paused and gave her time to say, hey, do you understand what I read to you? And she wouldn't respond one way or the other except for to continue yelling. I mean, that seems to be the evidence of a refusal.
So the couple points I'd make on that, Your Honor, Ms. Treebwasser did agree to test more than once. And when you look at the hour plus of recordings in total, you know, we have the beginning of the process where she agrees to test. And then the trooper just repeatedly over and over again is going back to asking her whether she's is going to take a test or not. Are you going to take a test? Over and over. And when you listen to those recordings in context, it seems like, you know, over time they wear her down and she refuses. And yeah, I agree, you know, obviously her behavior was not appropriate during that time. She was obviously very upset with law enforcement in general, and this particular trooper during that time, she obviously did not conduct herself in an appropriate way. So we're not arguing that the jury's determination that she refused was wrong. You know, that's not one of our issues on appeal. The issue is that the jury was not allowed to hear the rest of the story. and that had Ms. Treibwasser been able to tell this entire story to the jury, that her counsel, had he been prepared and effective, would have been able to make those additional arguments to the jury and try to show the jury that there was something more going on here than just very limited evidence that the trial court allowed the jury. So I'd also like to focus on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. In my mind, this is kind of the clincher. You know, this whole appeal should turn on this ineffective assistance claim. Because we have trial counsel who showed up on the day of trial fully admitting to the court that he was not prepared. And I know the respondent in their brief tried to suggest that, no, it was Ms. Treibwasser's fault herself that her counsel was not prepared. But I don't think the factual record bears that out. You know, trial counsel openly admitted to the court throughout in different places in the trial transcript that he was not prepared, did not know the defense, was not familiar with the evidence. And in fact, that, you know, his point was that Ms. Treibwasser had fired him a week before. And I think it's implied in the record that, you know, during that week, during before trial, when most attorneys would be spending hours focusing on preparing the trial strategy, trial counsel here had been fired and did not continue to prepare for the trial and showed up on the trial day assuming that he would not be trying the case. So as I've laid out in the brief, you know, that the ineffectiveness of the trial counsel can be observed on multiple occasions, you know, failing to subpoena witnesses, not understanding that he had the power himself to subpoena witnesses instead of asking the court to do it for him. You know, not arguing, you know, legal theories that would be clear and apparent to any effective criminal defense attorney, and the other issues that I laid out in the brief. So as we suggest there, you know, had the attorney been effective, then the jury would have heard the whole theory of the case, would have seen the additional video evidence that the trial court did not allow, would have heard from other officers that were involved in this investigation, and that the outcome of the trial would have been different for a number of different reasons that I laid out in the brief. So overall,
counsel, this is obviously... you're also challenging sufficiency of the evidence on the threats of violence claim. I don't know how you get around the audio, which is pretty graphic, of the various threats about, I'm going to kill you with a knife, I will kill you, you know, multiple times throughout the exchange there. I don't know how you get around that audio for sufficiency of the evidence.
So thank you for that question. I guess two responses to that. First, that argument is, again, closely tied to the ineffective assistance argument. Any reasonable defense lawyer would have tried to argue the transitory anger sort of theory that, yeah, those words were used. But just because the words were used does not mean that they're true threats, does not mean that the trooper would have perceived them as actual threats, that the trooper would have been placed in immediate fear. But the second point there is that a threats of violence charge must be premised on an underlying crime that was threatened. So in this case, the state requested and the judge instructed the jury on threats of violence where the underlying threat was for first degree assault. So the first degree assault, one of the elements of that requires proof, you know, of immediacy. So what I laid out in the brief was on that word immediate, that both the context of the words that were used did not show any indication of immediacy, and that the circumstances where these words are being said while Ms. Treibwasser is under arrest with multiple law enforcement officers, you know, she's being allowed to, you know, freely walk around the police station. She's not in handcuffs. So that it's clear that the trooper would not have perceived these as real threats. It would have been obvious that, you know, Ms. Treebwasser was just venting her frustrations with the circumstances and with law enforcement. And an effective defense lawyer at trial would have presented that argument to the jury. So with that, I will give up the rest of my time and turn it over to Mr. Kenefick, and I'll be prepared for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And if you go ahead and mute, I would appreciate it. And counsel for respondent, when you're ready, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tyler Kenefick. I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. I agree with appellant's counsel that the main issue here is whether there was ineffective assistance of counsel. I think, as appellant's kind of pointed out, there was a lack of offer of proof provided as to whether the court actually rejected any of this evidence that appellant now claims that should have been brought forward. So the question then becomes whether appellant's trial counsel should have more properly brought forward that evidence. However, this comes into, I think, a main factual issue. And as appellant's counsel pointed out, the question of whether who's at fault as to the preparation is a factual determination. A factual determination that is best determined after a post-conviction hearing in which the parties could litigate who in fact was at fault for the lack of preparation. As it stands, the only appeal in front of this court is based on the record. And the record, if the trial transcripts demonstrate that appellant's attorney stated that this was, he was unable to prepare because Ms. Treebwasser was unwilling to work with him, unwilling to prepare for this case, focusing on a different case, not being able to meet with him and failing to discuss this case. That's the evidence that you have in front of you. Maybe Ms. Treebwasser has a different version of events, but there is no factual record, no factual determination to determine which side is correct. And that's why post-conviction court would have been appropriate in this case. Here, the record does not indicate ineffective assistance. The defense attorney went out of his way to explain why he was unable to prepare. But he also went out of his way and probably further than he in all right should have in making sure that Ms. Treebwasser was able to present a type of defense that she wanted. Obviously, this court's well aware that the ineffective assistance of counsel does not typically go into trial strategy. The attorney, trial counsel, had the absolute right to say, no, this isn't working. This isn't the proper strategy. We're going to go with what I'm saying. But because he's aware of the awkward position he was in with Ms. Treebwasser trying to fire him, he at all times tried to present all arguments that could possibly go forward. And that's kind of the situation he got himself. To be frank, I think he handled himself as appropriately as he could in under the circumstances given. And ultimately, an ineffective assistance of counsel determination is based on the standard that an objectively reasonable attorney would have in that situation. If you've got a client that's not willing to prep with you, not willing to discuss the case, all you can do is go in and do your best. And that's what the attorney did here. The circumstances he was given were tough and were something that I think he handled appropriately. But as I stated, we don't have a proper factual record because there hasn't been a post-conviction hearing to determine exactly who's at fault as far as the lack of preparation. However, even if it was determined that there was an objective, that the trial counsel's attorney's behavior went below the objective standard, they still have to get past the second prong. The second prong of Strickland requires that there would be a reasonable probability the outcome would have been different. Here, most of the evidence was caught on tape. The jury was able to hear the video, able to hear the recordings, able to hear argument from counsel. They were able to look at all that. And the evidence, as your honors have pointed out, is pretty overwhelming, specifically on the threats of violence, as that was a continued threat throughout the entire time that was recorded. With that, the jury was able to see that, and nothing that the appellant would have brought would have changed that fact. They would have seen these threats. They would have seen everything that would go forward.
What do you make of the argument about immediacy as it applies to first degree assault, that she's not anywhere near a knife, she's in a police station or police custody, and there was no immediacy?
And Your Honor, I did address this in my brief, but I think that comes from a misconception of what a threat of violence is. A threat of violence doesn't require immediacy. If we had charged the appellant with first degree assault, then yes, those might have been issues, because we would have had to prove that there was a fear of immediate harm. But it's a threat of causing immediate harm. I think the example I gave in my brief was, if the underlying offense is murder, the state doesn't have to prove that the victim is dead. Otherwise, we'd be charging them with murder. Threat of violence is necessarily future-based. It's saying that in the future, I'm going to do this act to you that qualifies as an underlying offense. Here, the threat to stab Trooper Bozer with a knife or shoot her or take her head off or kill her is clearly within the realm of first-degree assault. Therefore, the threat to do that would fall within that purview, regardless of whether there was an immediate requirement there. To address the point as far as transitory anger, I don't think that any competent attorney would bring that up. In this case, you have multiple threats throughout a long period of time and consistent behavior throughout. This isn't an instance where it was a momentary lapse when he said, I'm going to kill you. It was, I'm going to kill you with a knife. I'm going to cut your head off, separated by minutes. That's by definition not transitory. That's an ongoing threat and something that gives the individual being threatened specific reason to fear or reasonable apprehension that that's going to come forward to them at the end. Additionally, I note that the evidence brought forward as far as a bias wouldn't really affect any sort of determination on this threat of violence. In fact, if anything, it would bolster the state's case because it would show that there's a deeper ingrained anger from appellant towards law enforcement. Because as it stands now, her actions are kind of nonsensical. Why are you threatening to take off this trooper's head if you were just arrested for a DWI? But if it's put under the context of appellant's belief that there's some multi-agency conspiracy out to get her, suddenly there's a stronger motive for that threat of violence. So the actual purported bias does nothing to undercut the conviction for threats of violence. And frankly, it does nothing to undercut the conviction of refusal, because as the court is well aware, the standard for a stop or a probable cause for arrest is objective. The standard for, or whether the officer had a proper motive, is a subjective determination that isn't relevant to that determination. And that kind of falls in line with appellant's claim that he should have been able to bring forward this argument that there was a pretextual stop in order to succeed at omnibus. But the case law is clear that it doesn't matter what his subjective intent was, the officer's subjective intent was in conducting an arrest or conducting a stop. So that wouldn't at all be relevant to the determination whether the stop is valid. At best, it could be seen as attempting to change the law by raising a new issue. But that the fact that you're trying to change the law doesn't go anywhere near the second step of Strickland, which shows that there would be a reasonable probability that the result would be changed, or that there was an abuse of discretion with the judge following established precedent. I think those are primarily the issues that I wanted to cover. Obviously, open to any questions if the court has any, but otherwise I would forfeit the remainder of my time.
All right, I'm not seeing any questions from the panel. Counsel, thank you for your argument. And counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for your rebuttal, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. For my rebuttal, I'd just like to kind of review what happened in this case from a more of a broad standpoint. This was a long litigation, obviously very difficult and frustrating for Ms. Treibwasser. She went through multiple attorneys because she was not satisfied with the representation she received and wasn't able to get her voice heard in court throughout the process. While that was happening, Ms. Treibwasser maintained for months and months that there was this evidence that should exist, that should be disclosed by the county attorney's office. She had her attorneys, make repeated requests for, give us this video evidence. And a county attorney that was assigned to the case, not Mr. Kenefick, but prior counsel, responded affirmatively saying, this evidence does not exist. And it was only through Ms. Treeboiser's own efforts and her lawyer's efforts that they figured out that the evidence does exist, and it was finally disclosed a year later. Then they had that evidence, and Ms. Treeboiser wanted to be able to raise her claims and was prevented from doing that in the omnibus hearing and the trial. Once she got to her trial, Ms. Treeboiser was given an impossible choice. Ms. Treeboiser was dissatisfied with her attorney on the day of her trial. She had fired her attorney, was not satisfied with his representation, had even consulted with and was ready to bring on a new attorney, but she was not given that option. She was only given the choice of proceeding pro se, bringing in the new lawyer who turns out was not available that quickly, or going to trial with a lawyer who was not prepared to present her defense. So she was left with that impossible choice. You know, of course, I think anybody would choose, you know, at least having the lawyer instead of trying to go pro se. But this resulted in Ms. Treeboiser not being able to present her complete defense. This is a constitutional issue. You know, the prosecution gets to present its evidence and its theory of the case, and the defense gets to do the same. So here, Ms. Treeboiser was denied that right to present her complete defense, largely due to the ineffectiveness of her counsel, who was not prepared to handle this trial. So for those reasons and the other reasons outlined in our brief, we're asking the court to reverse this conviction for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments today and your briefs in this matter. We will issue an opinion in the statutory timeframe, and the case is submitted. You are free to go ahead and exit out of Zoom. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.